Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, and welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. Of course, I am your host, Chris Martinson. Today, we're speaking with Rob Hopkins, somebody I've spoken with before on the other end of the interviewee cycle. And Rob's a true pioneer of the movement in our adaption to a post-peak world. Rob leads a vibrant new movement of towns and communities, cities that utilize local cooperation and interdependence to shrink their ecological footprints. He's developed the concept of transition initiatives with a couple of other gentlemen, communities that produce their own goods and services, curb the need for transportation, take other measures to prepare for a post-oil future. Now, while transition shares certain principles with greenness and sustainability, it's a deeper vision concerned with reimagining our future in a self-sufficient way that's built upon resiliency, a concept I am really familiar with and very much in support of. From his hometown in Totnes, UK, the original transition town started there, he offers to help hundreds of similar communities that have sprung up around the world, in part through his blog transitionculture.org and through writings. So welcome, Rob. It's an honor to have you as our guest today and to speak with you again.
Hi, Chris. Yeah, lovely to be talking to you again.
Great. So could you, for the people who may not have heard about transition towns, can you elaborate on the founding mission behind transition towns and what it is?
Well, I guess it comes out of many of the same motivations that are of interest to those who would be listening to your podcasts around economic contraction, around peak oil, also around climate change, and these sort of putting all of these issues together. Our analysis was that actually what we lack enormously now is, as you say, resilience at the local level, is that ability to withstand shock. And Ian Dowie, who used to manage Crystal Palace Football Club in London here in the UK, he used to describe resilience as bounce-back ability. And in transition, we take that idea of bounce-back ability but add on to it and say, actually, the process of making the places that we live more bounce-backable, if that's the word, could actually be the making of those places. And that at the moment, when the flight of global capital from communities such as this means that we don't have very much to fall back on. And originally it came out of an analysis around peak oil and the argument that, you know, when oil becomes very, very expensive, the price becomes very volatile, then the globalized way of doing everything becomes very, very fragile, very, very vulnerable. And so to put back that kind of more localized economy, we argue, isn't something that you do just because it's kind of a nice thing to do. It will actually, within time, inevitably become the economic mainstay of the places where we live. So we use this term of localization as economic development. So this isn't about sort of localization as an idea that just hangs around on pinboards in Whole Foods shops. This is around localization being the idea that underpins how we start as local economies to think about our future. So meeting more of our own needs in terms of food, closing those cycles, community-owned energy companies, setting up the infrastructure that we're going to need, but in such a way that it benefits our communities rather than all the money just pouring out through the holes. So it's very much about looking forward. It's very much about progress. It's very much about framing that in the context of the scenario that we're moving into, not sticking our heads in the sand, not running around panic with a panic look in our eyes, but looking at this as a one-off, tremendous historic opportunity to rethink some basic assumptions.
And of the things that need rethinking, I guess something that was sort of an act of faith on a lot of communities' part was that we all do whatever we do our jobs, and we spend our money, and somehow it all balances out. But if you back up just a couple steps, if you're a family, you know that if you spend more than you earn, you are slowly getting poor. Similarly, I guess the analogy here is for a community, if you are importing more than you're exporting, whether that's liquid fuels or food or clothing or whatever those things happen to be, if that balance of trade is not in your favor, you are slowly eroding. And I guess as we look across this landscape, where things have now, complexity's caught up with us. It's a very complex environment to live in. And I, my view is that the communities that can grasp that, see the opportunity in that, can say, how do we maintain control of the things we can? In some cases, that might be, as you know, if you don't have energy, if you can use less of it, that's the equivalent of importing less. So that starts to work in your favor. So this is really about knowing what our sources of wealth are, understanding them, understanding where we're hemorrhaging wealth, controlling that to the best we can, and that as we cast forward, I guess the idea would be some communities are going to fare better than others in large measure how they approach this part of that story. Is that what you mean by economic development?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous opportunity here for places that get ahead of the curve. You know, if when you look at this through the eyes of peak oil as a challenge, then the contraction of the energy that underpins globalization is inevitably going to contract. And so the distances over which we're able to do things is going to get shorter. But actually, to put in place the infrastructure you need in order to have a different approach, a more resilient approach, that doesn't happen overnight. You know, we're talking a longer kind of process. So the sooner places get underway and get started with it, the better, I think. I mean, in the UK, every year, we export the same amount, about 1.5 million kilos of potatoes to Germany as we import from Germany. Which really benefits nobody apart from, I mean, if somebody gave me an English potato and a German potato, I think I'd be pushed to tell the difference, really. And all it really benefits is petrol companies and road-making companies and creating work for lorry drivers. And actually, the process of closing the loop and consuming more of the produce locally and recreating those markets isn't just good from the perspective of using less fossil fuel, creating less carbon emissions. It's also really good in terms of our being more connected to the place around us, to feeling part of an agricultural community, eating fresher food that's in season, all that kind of thing. So sometimes things are presented, things that we need to do are presented as being some kind of a retreat. But I think, you know, when we talk about resilience, we're not just talking about community resilience, we're talking about personal resilience, ecological resilience, all of those things go hand in hand if we get it right. I mean, it's important as well to say that the concept of resilience is something that isn't necessarily a good thing. You know, you could imagine a resilient community that isn't so good in terms of social justice and community ownership and that side of things. So it's really important that from day one we get those things right and that the models we put in place are based on good models that are going to be sustainable in the longer term.
And how would you define sustainable in the longer term?
Well, in such a way that they aren't going to be hemorrhaging money from the place, that they aren't going to be perpetuating and deepening social inequality. Rather, they're going to be about bringing that community together. So if, for example, you design a local food system which is all based around some kind of feudal approach where it's all owned by one family and everybody else kind of works for that family, we may be getting organic potatoes, but we're not necessarily building the kind of social cohesion and more equity that actually we're going to need in order for that to be sustainable.
Right. So if we default into letting circumstances prescribe that to us, we might be back to the future, as it were, back to a feudal state last seen in the 1800s or something.
People who write about the idea of localization, you know, they talk about what academics call it reflexive and unreflexive localization, which you could just to mean, you know, a really good, healthy form and a really dreadful form. And we can look back through history at some pretty dire versions of localization, which may have been more resilient than they were today, but they were oppressive and patriarchal, hierarchical, and so on and so on. So I think at this stage now, when we're starting the process of laying out what we want to be moving towards, it's really important that we do that and set those foundations in place properly at this stage, I think.
And so your view then is that sufficient resources and willpower and energy exist at this stage to make that transition smoothly or relatively smoothly? Where do you stand on that?
I don't know for sure. I don't think anybody knows for sure. But my hope is, yes, that there would be the resources to do that, but we need to be skillful about it. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that some transition groups do is what we call an energy descent action plan, or because transition originally has its roots in permaculture, which is a design system, You know, we argue there needs to be an element of actually planning what we're going to do, of collectively coming together, thinking about what we want to do, and then actually moving towards it. This isn't something that will come around by accident. And I think that's one of the things that, distinguishes transition from previous kind of environmental community processes, in that it does, it's very ambitious, and it starts out with those kind of smaller things that we're all familiar with local green groups doing, like growing vegetables and digging up lawns and swapping this, that, and the others. But it's very ambitious in terms of where it's going. And in the book that I've just finished, which will be coming out in October, The Transition Companion, that's one of the things that really distinguishes it, that it starts out with those smaller projects, but it says this is a collective design process, that you need to be thinking about this process of intentional localization, and then starting to move towards it, so that the aim is that you're creating your own banks, your own energy companies, your own food systems that are based from the outset on those on those good principles.
So then this Transition Companion, improves the state of the art. Some learnings have been wrapped into that over what's happened since the original Transition book. What else can you tell us? What's new in this book, and what can we look forward to in there?
Well, it's entirely new. It's an entirely new book. And basically, the Transition Handbook, which came out in 2008, said, what would it look like if there was something a bit like this that did something like this? And it was very early on in the whole process. There were maybe 20 or 30 transition initiatives when it was written, and there were some projects underway. But it was kind of a speculative vision of what the kind of movement that felt most appropriate at the time would look like. So over the time that's gone on since, we've gone from that 20 initiatives up to many hundreds of them in 35 countries now around the world. Mm-hmm. And I often think of transition as being like a huge social experiment, in that we had a very simple model, a very simple set of tools, principles that have gone out all around the world, and people have tried them out, experimented with them in settings as diverse as favelas in São Paulo, cities in the US, villages in England, all different parts of London, and so on and so on. And what I've tried to do in this book is to pull back what seem to be the learnings from that. What's been people's experience? What's working? What's not working? Where do we find ourselves? What are the stories people are telling about their successes, about their failures? It's a very honest book, a very straightforward book, and it pulls together transition as a different model. So it's really about the idea of transition not being something that there's a prescriptive model. Mm-hmm. You start with this, and then you do this, and then you must do this before you think about doing this. It's more thinking about it as being like a series of ingredients, a collection of ingredients that people assemble in their own way. So it's like making a cake. You know, everybody will make a cake in a different way. There are certain steps that you have to do. You can't just chuck the butter and the flour in a bowl and put it straight in the oven and hope for a cake. You have to go through certain stages, but within that, you very much are free to arrange things how you like. So it draws together these ingredients, these tools, which are things that we've seen where a transition group has come up with a problem or a challenge and has come up with a solution that we've seen replicated enough times to have some kind of faith it's going to work. So I think it's very, very rich in stories, in photos from around the world, in their posters, their artwork, their stories, their experiences, and pulling all of that together into something that's very, very flexible but very effective. So it's been a very deeply collaborative process creating it as well, you know, putting up drafts and getting people to comment on them, and I'm really thrilled with it. Yeah,
I think that's a fabulous approach, because you know this we're in a very complex environment, and it's going to shift in very complex ways. I'm going to say unpredictable ways. Local mileage will vary. There are local different sources of wealth and assets and liabilities, all of which need to be accounted for. So the idea that there's a perfect recipe, which everybody wants, but it really seems not to be something we should really be seeking at this stage. Rather, there's this idea that this is going to be an incredible period of discovery and creativity and inquiry into how things are shifting. So it's fabulous that you're collecting that. What if we could go to both sides of that tail set, you know, what's been working and what hasn't been working so far?
I think the things that have been working have been, there are some very exciting projects starting to emerge in terms of community energy companies. Mm-hmm. There's some fantastic community engagement stuff that people have been doing. There's some really beautiful stories of projects of just people identifying a problem and applying that sort of creative transition thinking, which is playful and fun, and coming up with some really good solutions. So I've certainly that process of gathering in stories has been really, really heartening, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the degree to which I started out the book thinking, okay, so where's transition going now? Where does it feel appropriate to me that this book argues that it should move? And one of those things was around enterprise, was around not waiting for government or large corporations to start putting in place the business models that we need now. It's really down to us to get on with it and to make it viable and stop moaning around the fact that actually nobody's doing anything, when actually we could be doing stuff if we were able to step our game up and get the right people together and start putting these things in place. But what was really interesting then was going out and looking around at what transition groups were doing and finding there were actually loads of those things emerging already. You know, what they call social enterprise, businesses that are set up with a larger remit rather than just making profit for the owner, but of actually having a wider social benefit to the community around it. And finding all sorts of things from vegetable box distribution schemes, local food growing schemes, very, very ambitious community energy organizations, community shops, community pubs, community breweries, these kind of things. They weren't my idea, they were already out there, you know, so it was really exciting to see that. I think some of the things that maybe don't work so well, I think the thing that came through time and again was the importance of setting groups up properly from the beginning. That actually sometimes we all come together with this great enthusiasm and inspired by work such as yours or mm-hmm. Seeing the end of suburbia or wherever that momentum comes from of mm-hmm. thinking, my God, we need to do something here. But then we're so driven and so compelled and so enthused that actually we just, you know, think all that stuff about getting a group set up properly so that everybody knows what everyone's doing, that you know how you're going to communicate properly. All that stuff you think, oh, we're in too much of a rush for that. We'll do that later. We're just going to do stuff. And actually the initiatives who we've seen who've had difficulties have been the ones where they haven't got those group processes in place. And then there's all, you know, disagreements, and then those groups fall apart. I mean, a very, very small percentage, actually, but that's one of the key learnings, really, has been the importance of getting all that group stuff done from the beginning.
Right. So it's clear some people, when they first look into this landscape, and this happened to me, it's easy to come away with a fair degree of urgency. So I imagine somebody who's sitting in Europe today and is looking at the relative levels of paralysis and attempts to fix the economic system and things aren't working could look into that situation with some degree of alarm and conclude that perhaps change was coming quickly. How does one balance that tension between the desire to act and the desire to set things up properly? How does one navigate that space?
Well, what we argue in the Transition Companion is that there are very simple tools and approaches which can be woven into the first few meetings of a group like that, which just mean that from then on everybody knows where they're at and everybody knows what's happening and the whole thing moves forward much, much more smoothly and with much less risk of difficulty. And, you know, designing in a commitment to good communication, that sort of stuff, makes a big, big difference. And we've seen that time and again. You know, those projects that are really, really thriving are the ones that just gave that stuff a little bit of space at the beginning to allow it to really bed in, and now they're off doing really quite extraordinary things because, you know, that sense of that sense of urgency that drives people to think about this. You know, you only, it sounds a bit overdramatic, so you only get one chance of doing this, but actually if a transition group comes together and then they all fall out with each other, then it takes a while for maybe other people to come in and say, well, let's pick this up and keep it moving forward. So it's really good to just to get it going from the start, because it's really extraordinary when you see what those groups can do when they've got the right foundations in place.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So, speaking on this a little bit, where do you see us on the peak oil timeline now versus when you first started?
Well, when we first started, nobody knew at all what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Peak oil was something that rarely made it into the media. It was a fairly obscure sort of backwater, I guess. And it was only because, you know, through meeting Colin Campbell and spending time with Colin Campbell that you actually were able to get some really rich kind of information about it at that stage, and somebody who was very compelling in terms of arguing that. You know, now, five, 6 years later, it's pretty much a mainstream kind of recognition, I think. It's moved very, very quickly, and remarkable how that's happened, I think. I think obviously the economic unraveling that has begun is means that we're in a very, very different kind of a landscape. I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, because transition is underpinned by those three things: peak oil and climate change and the whole economic issues. That actually each of those issues kind of pulse at different times. And I think, you know, in peak oil, Colin used, when I first met him, he was talking about that idea of the bumpy plateau. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not you just go up to a neat little peak and then sort of start plummeting away down the other side. You bump along the top for a while, which you're going up and down and up and down. But actually, on the downward sides of those, which is what we're on now, people really stop caring about environmental things, because the pressure on the money in their pocket becomes so intense. Climate change, peak oil, these things aren't such an issue. But then as soon as you get back into anything resembling economic growth or any kind of an activity, those issues become very much more to the fore. So I think we're an interesting sort of pulsing backwards and forwards between being interested in those issues and being absolutely in a blind panic about the financial things. We're very much, I find it, at a local level, focused on where is the economic activity going to come from. And when I look around at our local council here, our local business organizations, they're still focused on this idea that when we get back to growth in 2 or 3 years, we're going to do this, that, and the other. We're going to do all this building. We're going to do all this, that, and the other. And whenever I give talks, I will start out by saying, okay, for the next hour, we're not going to use the term when we get back to growth. Okay, we're going to park that at the door, and we're going to have a space in this room where we can talk as though that's not the case. Because actually, for people who work in local government, business, and so on, they don't really get to sit in that space very often. But that's really, really important. So, for me, I mean, I'm not a peak oil expert. I'm not an economic expert. I'm sufficiently convinced that those two things are enormously compelling, pressing challenges that aren't going anywhere other than becoming more pressing challenges. So my focus is really, what do we do? What do we do on the ground about it? But that's my observation, is that we tend to sort of waver between thinking maybe it'll all get all right again, so we can worry about peak oil and climate change, or being really despondent about the fact that it's all going down the tubes, in which case we forget those issues. But what's beautiful about the concept of resilience is that it draws in all those things. Mm. That it's about being resilient to climate change, about being resilient to peak oil, it's about being resilient economically. And that's a kind of a steady stream that you can ride through all of those things. It's a common language and a common focus that whether people are worrying about peak oil or whether they're worrying about the coins in their pocket is still something very steady and very constant.
Yeah, and those things probably, to some degree, will always be with us. Economic concerns have been in people's minds since the dawn of time, practically, when we came under the current system we're on. And that's really the framework I bring to this, is the idea that the system we have is just fundamentally changing. And let me be more specific. it cannot continue in the way and in the manner it had been going. And that's really hard to get to. It's a very emotional subject. It touches on beliefs for a lot of people, like faith in technology or belief in human spirit or, you know, our creativity, or you have to be optimistic, whatever the belief structures happen to be. And this is the interesting period of time I find us in, is that now there is more and more and more compelling evidence, whichever one of those spheres that you mentioned you want to look at, whether it's in the environmental sphere or whether it happens to be in the economic sphere, or you want to look in the energy sphere, it doesn't matter, or all three. But you can peek in there and say, wow, there's enough evidence here to suggest that the prudent thing to do would be to prepare as if we're not going back to normal. We're not going back to growth, that the ways in which we've become accustomed to things working is now shifting right before our very eyes. Certainly anybody who's in the economics sphere, the debt markets do not work like they used to. And we've got about 3 years of proof of that, and we'll probably have a few more in front of us. And my theory is that we're not ever going to see those return to what people knew for the past 20, 30, 40 years. So here we are, and the question then becomes, what are the sorts of things we do and we can do? And your approach has been to take it at the community level, community being as large as cities, I suppose, but at that level rather than the state level, as it were, or even the global level. Why is it that you started there?
Because, well, firstly to say that we don't for a moment say that the local and the community level is the only level where any meaningful change can be effected. Obviously, we need national government, we need local government, we need business, we need all these things all pulling together. But I guess, for me, it feels like the local will be the scale that will be the most viable. You know, James Kunstler says, you know, the future will be intensely and inherently local, or something like that. And David Fleming, who was a brilliant economist here who died last year, used to say that localization stands at best at the limits of practical possibility, but it has the decisive argument in its favor that there will be no alternative. Hmm. So we very much took that as the focus, because it felt like it was the part that was being neglected. It's the part that people are passionate about and that they care about. And, you know, when you were saying there about debt and everything, I mean, my sense is that people will get this at different points. And if we imagine that everybody needs to get this before we can actually do anything meaningful, we're not going to do anything meaningful in time. The idea with transition is really that if we can get things in place which just make sense, which don't ram peak oil and climate change and economic models down people's throats, but which become the things that are creating work for people, they become the things that people are proudest of because they are celebratory of the place and of the culture and so on. And I start to see that here in Totnes, in Devon, where I'm speaking to you from today, which is the first transition town in the UK. And what we've seen, I think originally when we started doing transition, I imagined it was an environmental process, but increasingly I think of it as a cultural process. Mm-hmm. In that it starts to become the story that the town tells about itself. Well, now when it starts to talk about its future, it talks about transition. People come to visit the place because of transition, and it increasingly becomes a thing that people are proud about, and the story that it starts to tell about itself. You know, there are now some businesses that are emerging here that are, it's early days, but there are businesses emerging here which are very much rooted in that, and lots more in the pipeline. Models like the Totnes Renewable Energy Society, which allows local people to invest in what will be two large wind turbines on the edge of Totnes, which will be owned by the community for the benefit of the community. These kind of things don't say that you have to believe in peak oil or climate change or the end of growth in order to be a part of it. They bring people on board because they're a celebration of the place. They feel fantastic. You'd rather have your money in a local energy company that you know the people who run it, you're excited about its progress, you know other people who are part of it, rather than just having them off in some distant shares in something that you have no control over. So I think we have only just really started to scratch the surface in terms of the potential power of this, I think. The localization as economic development is a really powerful idea. And, you know, in climate change, there's the very famous climate wedges model that says, well, at the moment we're rising like this, what we need to be doing is going down like this. So that will be made up of a number of wedges, sort of electric cars and so on and so on. I think that actually one of the big, big wedges of those could be intentional localization, if we can get it right. And I think once we've kind of proved that concept in a few places, it will really start to motor and really start to accelerate very sharply. You know, we have, so here in Lewes, in Sussex, Transition Town Lewes recently set up a local energy company. That energy company just launched the UK's first community-owned solar power station. They raised £300,000 from local people to put the panels on the roof of a local brewery, and that brewery brewed a special beer called Sunshine Ale to celebrate the launch. Now, these kind of things aren't about people taking people back to something worse than today. They're a step forward. They're about building resilience, bringing people together, giving them a sense of anything is possible in such a way that everybody benefits.
Fantastic. The part about the narrative is, it really caught me, because it's, you know, stories shape our own lives. National or cultural stories shape destinies. And really, I think we have an old story running, which may not be serving us any longer. A story of growth has been the one I focus on. And because we have that story, we act in certain ways. You cannot possibly open the newspaper without hearing about a political or monetary leader talking about the necessity of returning to growth. It's just axiomatic. We don't even discuss why that's true. We just have to get back to growth, growth in jobs, growth in the economy, growth in something. And obviously, if you just step back just even one full step from that story, you understand that can't be true forever, that there's at some point an end to that story. And I think we're there. And that's really the deep dis-ease that's being felt across the landscape by a lot of people, be they financially, ecologically, or energy focused. They know that there's something shifting in the story, but it's, I find, almost impossible to shift away from a story without being able to shift towards a different story. And so I'm hearing in your description that transition is offering a version, and people are seeing that and responding to it. And it really doesn't matter what lens they're peering through. In fact, they don't even have to have any lens. You're saying that if done correctly, people don't necessarily even have to believe in or look at or understand anything about those three sort of views or any other views that they can participate. Is that what you're finding?
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, Richard Heinberger once said about transition, that it feels more like a party than a protest march. And I think, you know, when you were saying about moving away from one story and towards another, there's two ways you can do that. You can either sort of try and belittle and shame and terrify everybody that they have to move away from this story. This story is finished. There's no future in this story. You're rubbish if you still believe in this story. Or you create the other story that we want people to move to in such a way that it's just so enticing. And it's such a more nourishing, more enriching, more celebratory place to be that you don't need to belittle the first one. And I had a real reminder of this the other day, actually, and the power of story, in that about 3 years ago here in Totnes, inspired by some examples of printed local currencies from mainland Europe and from the US, particularly the Berkshire's currency in Massachusetts, I got together with a couple of people here in Totnes quite early on in the life of TTT and said, what would it look like? Oh, yeah, that was it, because I went into an office here, and they had on the wall framed a banknote from 1810 that was issued by the Totnes Bank, a Totnes £1 note. And I said, what would it be like if we issued, if we reissued a Totnes pound now? How would that work? And we talked about it, and then someone said, well, don't you have to have permission from somewhere to do something like that? And we asked a few people, and nobody seemed to know, so we thought, well, let's just have a go and print them and see. So we printed just 300 Totnes pounds, and 18 shops said they would take them, and we just ran it as a pilot for about 3 months just to see if people liked it and what happened and so on. People did like it. The shops really liked it. So that scheme has then grown we've had two different issues of notes now. It inspired other places, Brixton, Lewes, Stroud, Hoyk in Scotland, a few other places, to then do printed currencies. And then that has now inspired the city of Bristol, which is a large city in the southwest of England, to launch the Bristol Pound, which will be a mixture of a printed currency and a really, really innovative electronic currency, which is based on people's mobile phones. The local council are behind it. They're very, very supportive. They're putting money into it. They're going to say that, you know, people will be able to pay their taxes using Bristol Pound.
Nice.
And actually, that's all kind of grown just from that thing of saying, what would it be like? But doing it in such a way that it's a really interesting story. So that story of Totnes prints its own money had such a sort of a power to it and a resonance for so many people. But obviously, when we started doing that, we didn't think, oh, yes, well, a part of our cunning master plan for world domination is that in 4 years' time, the city of Bristol will do one based on currencies. But these ideas create a push, and they draw people. And I think it's one of the things that I've learned increasingly. You know, you were asking what have been the learnings from 4 or 5 years of doing transition. I think one of them is that you have no idea where these things are going to go. Once you start these things off, once you kick these things off, if you do them with a good intention and get them out there, there's such a power to that, much, much more than we might actually be aware of at the time.
All right, and trust and follow. Just trust that good intention of creativity. Creativity spawns much. So many good things can come from it. I'm just to follow up on that story of the money. So you didn't ask permission. Have you had to ask for forgiveness, or did nobody come knocking?
Nobody came knocking, no.
Oh, well, that's nice.
No, nobody came knocking. And in fact, we formed an advisory panel of some of the sort of great and the good alternative economists, you know, Richard Douthwaite and Bernard Lyotard and people. And we'd say to them, are we allowed to just print money and call them Totnes pounds? And they said, we've got no idea. Try it and see. I thought, what kind of an advisory panel is that? You know, but actually, I think the legal status is kind of a bit like book tokens or those kind of vouchers.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's that thing of there's a Woody Allen film, I can't remember which one it is, where he sat in a tree, starts with him sat in a railway carriage, and it's all black and white, and he's surrounded by the most miserable, long-faced, depressed-looking people he could get together to make the film. And then he looks across into the carriage and next to him in the station, and everybody's having this fantastic party and all drinking champagne and everyone's gorgeous. And this woman blows him a kiss through the window, and then he looks back at this carriage he's sat in with all these brilliant kind of Woody Allen. But actually, I think that we should be trying to make transition feel like the carriage on the other side of the platform that you just really, really want to be in, because that's where the party's happening.
Fantastic. I like that view a lot. Here we are. The world is, in my view, in that bumpy plateau of this peak oil era. And what's your view? So how does this all? So you put your forecast hat on. You look in and you see where we are in this bumpy plateau. Best guess. And the question here is, you know, will we have that critical mass of transition towns or new narratives or whatever we need? And to really, you know, sort of have a relatively smooth transition, are we going to find ourselves with some well-prepared communities and some at varying levels of vulnerability? How do you see this playing out?
It was really fascinating this year. We had the Transition Network Conference, which we do once a year. And one of the things that I had always wondered about transition, because as I said at the beginning, you know, this is an experiment, was when you get to a time when things get really difficult, you know, when the chips are down and things are clearly very, very, very tricky, how does transition inform the response? And there's that very famous quote by Milton Friedman about, in times of real change, it's the ideas that are on the table that are the ones that are picked up and examined. You know, might that be the case for transition? And so we had people there from various parts of the world. We had some people there from Brazil, where transition has just been on fire for the last 18 months. All across Brazil, in the very poor areas, the favelas in São Paulo, the more wealthy, more middle class parts of Brazil. And they had terrible floods there about 10 months ago, and there was one town that was largely just washed down the hill. There was transition training going on nearby, and they said, anybody who's from this community can come and do the training for free. quite a few people came and did that. And now transition is one of the key elements that's feeding into how that community is redesigning itself. In New Zealand, there were parts of New Zealand where there were earthquakes recently, where they've had transition groups very active there for the last 3 years, putting in place time banks and this kind of thing. And when things were really, really difficult, quite a lot of people got in touch and said, you know, we're so grateful for having those initiatives in place, and what they've done has been really, really an integral part of that response. And in Japan as well, you know, where they've had all kinds of dreadful mm-hmm. difficulties there over the last year or so, again, the transition groups have been very much a part of that. So it's that question about, does transition get into the drinking water? Does it get into the DNA so that when things get difficult, that's one of the key tools that gets picked up? And as I said before, with the pound story, you know, once you start things, you have no idea where they go. And so that was really fascinating insight for me. That actually, in those three places where things were really tricky, that was what had been picked up. And also, you know, the idea of whether we'll get enough people on board and enthused. I think sometimes there's this obsession with you have to get the kind of unconverted on board. I think that is the case in that it's a good thing to aspire to, but what's as important or more important even is that the people who are on board, the people who are already willing to put their shoulders to this, have the right tools in order to be able to get moving. And in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, he says, you know, it's somewhere between 15% and 17% of people in the community constitutes the tipping point, which is why I think we know we are seeing some places that have had transition going on for a while really starting to get moving and get motoring. But those tipping points, you never know when those tipping points come, when all of a sudden the idea that actually you shift your focus to investing more locally and building these kind of institutions just becomes completely accepted as mainstream. Well, it's blindingly obvious, isn't it?
So to paraphrase Churchill, I believe he was the one who said that in a time of crisis, the solutions that get adopted are the ones that happen to be lying around. So if we get into this crisis period, like you mentioned with the floods in Brazil or other crises, however they happen to come about, the fact that there's a template nearby in another community or perhaps in that same community that can be then used is just that's a natural thing. That's how humans tend to operate anyway. So good for us for having some templates of how to organize, how to work, how to be effective, how to take matters into our own hands. With that being one of the surprising sort of determinants of success here.
Yeah, because it's not about waiting for permission. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's going to kind of commission us to design what a more localized, more resilient economy is going to be like. You know, it's really about just getting on with it and doing it with creativity and a good motivation in that way. And actually, I think it is really fascinating observing in places the degree of pride there is about the transition group that's underway and the projects they've got going on. And, you know, here that, I mean, we did a big project here called Transition Streets, which was about working to try and support behavior change, but on a street-by-street level. So it wasn't about saying the council needs to come in and give everybody grants or whatever. It was about get out on your street, get a group of 6 to 10 households together. Here's a simple thing to do where you meet 7 times 1 week, you look at energy, then you look at water, so on and so on, look at food, and you reduce your emissions, you reduce your consumption. And on average, each household cut its carbon emissions by about 1.5 tons, saved itself £700 or £800 a year. But actually, when you would meet people in the street who had done it, and I met a lot of people here walking around just after having done it, they didn't talk to me about how much carbon they'd saved. They didn't talk to me about how much less oil they used, or about the global economy. What they talked about was how they now knew Dave over the road, who was teaching them such and such, how them and Sandra down at number 7 were now working on that waste piece of ground at the end of the road and turning it into something else. It was that social cohesion that people were really, really craving. So if we can design this process in such a way that it brings people together in that kind of celebratory way, all the things that kind of spin off of that build people's commitment to this kind of process. But that can't be done from the top down. That's a process that has to happen from the ground up.
So I know there's somebody listening to this right now who feels like they're sitting in a glum boxcar, and they're looking through a window of this podcast and saying, wait a minute, there's a party happening over there. How do people find out about their local transition initiatives, if there happens to be one, or go about starting one? How does somebody become engaged with this who's listening right now?
Well, there's some very good resources online. If you're listening in the U.S., transitionus.org has a very good way of finding out where all the initiatives are, some very good tools for getting started. In a month or so, they'll be able to get a hands on the Transition Companion that'll be able to tell you that stuff. But if you're not in the U.S., then transitionnetwork.org has a map of the world with all the initiatives and a Transition Near You button where you can find out what's happening, who are the people, what are the projects, what are the initiatives that are happening around where you live. If there's a group, then go along and get involved and bring what you're passionate about to it. It's transition is really a process if you're really passionate about food, then transition doesn't require you to go and sit through lots of boring meetings about energy or whatever. It's about what you're passionate about. You bring that to this process and you make that happen. So there's lots of resources out there. You can go on YouTube and type in Transition Towns, and there's a whole range of different things on there. There's a film we made called In Transition 1.0, and version 2.0 is coming out at the end of the year. There's all kinds of materials online which pull together those stories. There's the Transition US does a newsletter, Transition Network does a monthly newsletter of what's going on. There's plenty out there. Jump in. The water's lovely.
Fantastic. Well, I really want to thank you for your time today and for the enthusiasm, and most of all, for bringing your creativity and vision to the world, and then sitting back and watching it run and collecting the stories. I think that's just a fabulous model, and it's obviously been very successful. So all the best, and wonderful talking to you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. And thank you for your work also.
All right. You're welcome, and thanks for that. Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.